My name is Faith Libani. I'm a whip to the committee, presently chairing on behalf of my chairperson, who is at work outside Parliament. I think for us to start off in a good note, we should perhaps all introduce ourselves, starting from Mr. Nkikina, so that you know who's inside with us. Yes.
My name is Ralph Nkichima. I'm the chairperson of the Public Service Commission. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Johanna Mule Maluleke. I'm the member of Public Service and Administration Committee.
My name is Christina Mohali, member of Public Service and Administration Portfolio Committee.
My name is Dalita Michelle, member of Public Service and Administration.
Ibrahim Rasul, member of
the.
Thank you. My name is Pelele Tengeni. I'm the deputy chairperson of the Public Service Commission.
I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Public Service Office of the Public Service Commission and also responsible for corporate services.
Marshall Tedikofa, Director General, Office of the Public Service Commission.
Honorable Sanskari.
Ina van Skalkwyk, and I'm a member of the committee.
My name is Anshin Dreyer, member of this committee. And Madam Chair, I just want to wish to make a small correction. When you introduced yourself, you are the acting chair and we respect that fully, but there's no such position as a whip to this committee. We haven't elected such a position. The whip that you're referring to is the whip of the ANC, but it's not of the committee. I just wish to point that out and make that correction. Thank you.
The gentleman behind Honorable Dre. Sorry, I didn't get that. Can you please pass the mic?
Nkululeko Ngwana from Sunnytown.
Behind Nkululeko?
My name is Thabo Mokoni from SABC.
My name is Siyabonga Mkhwanazi from Independent Newspaper.
My name is Nozipho Gwaza, Parliamentary Officer for the Public Service Commission.
Leonard Ramatlakane, member of this committee.
Lungis Biela, Committee of the Center.
Good morning, I'm Payne from PMG.
Vukani Mthembu from the Office of the Minister of Public Service and Administration.
Shamila Abrams, Parliamentary Officer, Public Service and Administration.
I think in the corner at the back.
Andre Odon from SABC Radio News.
Sinai Kutsu from Port City Press.
The gentleman in front. Thank you. Thank you. Now that you all know each other. Oh, okay. I didn't recognize somebody came in.
Sorry, I'm running out. Linda is still from business day. How do you do that?
Yes, Linda is still from business day.
Thank you. Okay. I think for progress of the day, in terms of our agenda, we're basically going to be looking at presentation from the Public Service Commission on its strategic plan and the budget vote. And then we'll give some time for questions, comments, and any input. And then we'll have a tea break, hopefully if we're keeping to time, at 10:45 until 11 o'clock. and then later on another presentation from the Public Service Commissioner, the evaluation of the supply chain management practices. And thereafter, we'll also again give time for questions, answers, comments, and so on. And then we should be able to close by 12:30, hopefully. Okay, thank you very much. Without saying much, can I say, can we start with the presentation from the Public Service Commission?
Thank you very much, Chair. I just need to perhaps, I know that we have introduced ourselves, but I just thought that I should also reintroduce the Deputy Chair of the Public Service Commission, whom you have not seen in this committee. We have had several interactions with myself and the DG and the CFO on previous occasions, and also our web parliamentary officer. But our Deputy Chair, Mr. Pelele Tengeni, has recently been appointed on the occasion that I also was appointed. She's a commissioner who's based in KZN, and she has a lot of experience in the area of public administration. So I just thought I would do that, Madam Chair. Secondly, I think I would once more welcome the invitation that your committee has extended to us, Public Service Commission, to make a presentation on, particularly on the strategic plan of the Commission. We welcome that, but we also welcome the accommodation that you did give us, because we were originally scheduled to make this presentation next week. But unfortunately, next week we will be chairing a meeting of the All Africa Public Service Commission in Uganda. So we thank you very much for that consideration to be able to shift this presentation to this particular day. With those few words, I think that I will hand over to the DG to make the presentation of the strategic plan. The strategic plan, of course, as you know, is part and parcel of the regulatory framework in terms of the Public Service Commission and all organs in South Africa. It is. This particular one is a product of a number of planning sessions of the Commission, but it takes into account particularly the concerns of our stakeholders, including the comments that you made yourself in the interactions that we had last year, including also the input and the interactions that we had with the provincial legislatures throughout the country. The executive, in particular the Department of Public Service and Administration, with whom we have been assigned the duty of public service administration. So it is a product of all our stakeholders, and as we always do and we did in the past, to urge you to engage with the plan and be able to make the comments as and when you wish to make them. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. DG.
Thank you very much, morning, honorable members. The strategic plan of the Public Service Commission for the period ahead is based on three critical considerations, and this will become clear as we go into the presentation itself. The first one is that there is a certain consistent set of things that the Public Service Commission utilizes. In other words, instead of assessing new things each year, you have a consistent set of things that you measure over a period of time to make sure that you create a baseline against which you can assess progress over time. So you will see in the presentation, honorable members, that there are certain areas that we have been covering for a number of years now as the Public Service Commission, and the idea is to stay with those areas to ensure that progress over time can be measured. That is the first consideration. The second consideration is that we have also taken into consideration the outcome of the evaluation of the effectiveness of the Public Service Commission, the impact of the Public Service Commission. We commissioned an independent evaluation of the impact of our work. And based on the findings and recommendations emanating from that study,
we took those into consideration in shaping this medium-term strategic plan. And thirdly, we also took into consideration what are the critical priorities of our government at the moment. So you'll see when you get into the presentation and issues relating to anti-corruption and fighting crime, issues relating to rural development, issues relating to local government to a certain extent being reflected as well. The first slide there, just introducing the Public Service Commission, as you are aware, being an institution created by the Constitution, invested with the custodial oversight responsibility for the public service. Just also flagging the point the chairperson of the Public Service Commission made, Dr. Mdejima, this is the first medium-term strategic plan that we develop following the appointment of the new leadership of the commission, the chairperson and the deputy chairperson. So we've taken that opportunity to also critically look at how we have been functioning as a commission to shape this particular strategic plan. The mission and vision statement, at the core of this remains the focus on the promotion of the values and principles of public administration contained in the Constitution. So both in the vision and in the mission statement of the Public Service Commission, those are the critical consideration, ensuring professionalism, professional ethics, accountability, equitable, efficient, and effective public administration, corrupt-free public administration, responsiveness to the needs of the people of South Africa. Those are captured in Chapter 10 of the Constitution. The four programs of the Public Service Commission. Program one, administration, which covers the commissioners, management in the office, our corporate services branch. Program two, leadership and management practices, which focuses on the two areas of labor relations and leadership and human resource reviews. Program three, which is on monitoring and evaluation. Program four, which is integrity and anti-corruption. And as you go further into the presentation, we'll talk more about these programs and what the Commission intends doing in the years ahead. Starting with the program on the branch on leadership and management practices, there are two areas there. The one is labor relations improvement, and the other is leadership and human resource review. So here we focus first on labor relations improvement, where the PSC has played a key role over the years in terms of the resolution of grievances in the public service. This is contained and provided for both in the Constitution as well as in the grievance rules that public servants have to use in the resolution of grievances. We just reflect there on the figures as well for the financial year 9-10 that a total number of 563 grievances were referred to the Public Service Commission. And you'll see that only over half of those grievances were actually referred to the Public Service Commission without having followed the appropriate internal referral procedures, which means that the grievances have to be dealt with within the department and the internal departmental processes have to be exhausted first before they can be referred to the Public Service Commission. So we still have that kind of challenge where the grievances get referred prematurely to the Public Service Commission. There are time frames that have been specified that within 30 days the department, the executive authority, the MEC, the minister will have dealt with the grievance, but there is still a challenge in terms of those time frames being met. But we also indicate as part of this new medium-term strategic plan that there is provision in the amended Public Service Act for heads of departments to also lodge their grievances directly with the Public Service Commission. This provision was not there before. The provision was that at a national level they would lodge their grievances with the president. But with the amendment of the Public Service Act now, that provision is there that they can lodge their grievances directly with the Public Service Commission. However, in order for this to take effect, we need to have in place rules for HODs to lodge grievances directly with the Public Service Commission. We have developed those rules that have now been submitted to the Department of Public Service and Administration, and once those rules are finalized, we should expect that in this new period that lies ahead, the number of grievances that the Public Service Commission is handling may increase as a result of heads of departments themselves now also losing their grievances directly with the PSC.
In addition to dealing with the grievance resolution, there is work that we also do on assessing labor relations practices in the public service and advising on good practice. So in this particular financial year, what we'll also be doing is we'll be looking at collective bargaining practices in the public service. We intend doing a comparative study here to see how collective bargaining takes place at the moment in the public service. How does it take place elsewhere? What are the lessons that can be learned, and how can it be improved so that we can then advise the executive accordingly? We will also be looking at the critical area of precautionary suspension, because at the moment an official may be suspended, but not as a function, as a precaution, so that the department may conduct an investigation. But within a period of 60 days, a hearing must be held. We did a study on the management of suspensions a few years ago. Now we want to follow up to see the extent to which there has been improvement in the management of precautionary suspensions, because if they are not properly managed, you will have people who are on paid suspension for very long periods of time. A critical approach also in the period ahead is that of strategic partnerships with stakeholders, and the one that we will continue to nurture over this period is the one we have with the PSCBC, the Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council. We work with them to run the labor relations conference every second year, and the idea here is to achieve two things. Firstly, is to put certain positions on labor relations in the public service and share ideas between various players, organized labor, the employer, and so on, and invited guests as well. But secondly, in this particular conference, we also then have, parallel to the conference, training opportunities on grievance management, on chairing of disciplinary hearings, and so on and so on, which is quite a very useful tool around building capacity in the area of labor relations improvement. The second part of this program is what we call leadership and human resource reviews. Here we see ourselves being strategically placed to support processes that enhance the quality of public service leadership. One area that the committee is aware of is that of facilitating the evaluation of the performance of heads of departments. This is an area the Public Service Commission has been involved in for a few years now, and will be continuing with that based on the framework that is in place for the evaluation of heads of departments. The evaluation process itself is the responsibility of the executive, but the Public Service Commission facilitates by sharing the evaluations and by also playing a secretarial function in those evaluations. Also, in terms of the handbook, the Senior Management Service Handbook, heads of departments are required to file their performance agreements with the PSC. As we receive them, we review them and assess them, and where they are gaps in those performance agreements, we provide advice to the executive so that those gaps can be addressed. Based on our involvement in the evaluation of heads of departments and on the filing of performance agreements, we also compile trends, statistics, friends would say which AODs have not been evaluated, which AODs have not filed their performance agreements with the Public Service Commission, and that information is made available to the executive. A further area that we'll continue to focus on during this period in this regard is that of evaluating the implementation of the performance management and development system for senior managers in provinces. We have now conducted this study in a few provinces already, the Eastern Cape, the Northern Cape, the Northwest. We just completed Limpopo now, and this time around we will be taking that process to the Western Cape to assess the extent to which the performance management and development system for senior managers is being implemented. A critical study, because once again, as we have indicated before, if performance management is not being prioritized at the level of senior managers, you get concerns as to what will be happening at lower levels of the establishment. Still with this area of leadership and human resource reviews, a further focal area for us will be in the area of our oversight in terms of the skills and human resource management in the public service, and we're looking here at a specific project on human resource development practices. So you talk about skills development, you talk about capacity building, and you'll be looking at exactly what are the kinds of practices that departments follow to build capacity to develop the skills, how effective are these practices, and how can these practices be improved. We'll also be looking at the area of employee satisfaction in the public service within the workplace, and the implications of that in terms of how it contributes to what the job turnover and so on. I did mention earlier on that we will also be continuing our work on understanding what is happening at the sphere of local government. So in this area, we will be looking at recruitment and selection practices of senior managers at local government level, a study which we contribute to a better understanding of the challenges and good practices that exist at local government level and the steps that can be taken to improve the practice. The next program is that of monitoring and evaluation, and here once again we have two elements of it. One is governance monitoring, the other is service delivery and compliance evaluation. But first, talk about governance monitoring. We have continued over the years to run a transversal monitoring and evaluation system for the public service, where we have taken the constitutional values and principles of public administration and converted them into a monitoring and evaluation system with indicators and standards. So each year we take a sample of departments and assess the extent to which they comply with the values and principles of public administration as contained in the Constitution. We have assessed 131 departments thus far, and we will continue with this evaluation as we go into this new period. The focus this time will be looking at departments of agriculture at national and in each province, and we'll also be taking the offices of the premier, because those being a very critical centers of government at provincial level to ensure effective coordination of what is happening at provincial level. It will be very critical for us to look at how this offices are functioning. Just to emphasize also that what we are doing as an addition now, as we are continuing with, is once we have produced, and that's why we take departments within the same sector, like we take Office of the Premier, we take Department of Agriculture, is that once we've done all the departments, we produce also a consolidated report that begins to look at trends across this department, so that you can be able to compare the Department of Agriculture, for example, in the Western Cape, and the Department of Agriculture in the Eastern Cape. And we'll do the same with the offices of the premiers as well, where some comparisons will be made in terms of the findings of this assessment. On an ongoing basis, of course, we also seek to review and improve this M&E system that we use, and our interest is in ensuring that we strike a balance between compliance issues on the one hand and service delivery outcomes on the other, because it's not just a teaching exercise where you say they have this particular policy in place, but it's also looking at the kind of effectiveness that compliance is beginning to have on public administration. Continue with governance monitoring. In addition to applying that transversal M&E system, we also have a focus on programs evaluation, where we identify certain programs of government and evaluate their effectiveness. And since the introduction of this area of work, our focus has been on poverty reduction programs. So this time around, we'll focus on evaluations of programs in the agricultural sector, and we'll identify one of the programs there and evaluate its effectiveness and its impact, with poverty reduction being such a critical priority for government. This evaluation, we believe, also gives the TSC the opportunity to evaluate whether the selected programs are achieving their objectives. Once again, during this period, we'll continue with our flagship product, which is the State of the Public Service Report, a report that is organized according to the 9 constitutional values and principles, and gives them a high-level overview of the performance of the public service for that particular period that we are assessing. We'll continue with the practice of using a theme which will direct the way the report is done, and during the 2010-11 financial year, the theme of the State of the Public Service Report will be innovating for effective public service delivery, so that we'll be particularly interested in the extent to which innovative practices are being embraced in the public service and the extent to which they are contributing towards effective public service. A second area in this program is service delivery and compliance evaluation. We have remained interested in assessing the satisfaction levels of citizens because we believe at the end of the day, it is what citizens say about the quality of service delivery that matters. We have been piloting what we call a set of key drivers of citizen satisfaction, which we've just completed this financial year, and going into the period ahead now, we will be applying that instrument much more widely to assess the extent to which citizens are satisfied with the services that government is providing. We'll also be looking at this area of agencies, where agencies are being established to deliver services on behalf of government departments. And here we'll take a sample and look at the extent to which there is effectiveness in the use of this model in the area of the service delivery. Where are the gaps? And if this kind of model is to be continued, what measures should be put in place to make sure that it can indeed contribute effectively to service delivery? Still with the area of service delivery and compliance evaluations over this period, our inspections of service delivery sites, a methodology where the Public Service Commission goes to service delivery sites and experiences firsthand what is happening there in those sites of service delivery. We have done this in police stations, we've done this in clinics, we've done this in schools, and we'll be continuing with this during this particular financial year to see what the experiences are. Some of the inspections are unannounced, so that people do not expect that the Public Service Commission will show up, but then we do indeed arrive to collect information on the experiences there. And our focus will be on police, particularly on detective services at police stations. This is an area that has been flagged as one of government's priorities, if you look at the priorities that have been mentioned as part of the State of the Nation address, and we believe that the Public Service Commission, through its oversight work, can contribute towards an assessment of the practices in this area. Looking at the challenges that are being faced, the nature and extent of those challenges, the availability of resources, and so on. The third program is that of integrity and anti-corruption. It's got two components as well. The first is public administration investigation. The Constitution permits the Public Service Commission, mandates the Public Service Commission to conduct investigations, either on own accord, where the Commission itself decides to carry out an investigation, or on receipt of a complaint that would be launched through the various mechanisms that exist at the moment. The investigations relate to maladministration, allegations of corruption, maladministration, poor service delivery, and all these are the areas that we focus on. And if you look at the sources from which we get this complaint, they can be lost through the PSC's complaints rules, or they can come to us through the National Anti-Corruption Hotline. Through the investigations, the PSC is able to report on compliance with national norms and standards, to provide advice on best practice, and to recommend corrective action. The number of complaints that the PSC is receiving, obviously, for investigation, as indicated in the presentation, has seen a steady increase over the years. But it's not only through the complaints rules, it's also through the National Anti-Corruption Hotline that these complaints are received. When the hotline was established, to emphasize that it was established strictly for corruption-related allegations. But what has happened over the years is that people use it to also report service delivery complaints. In other words, no corruption is implied, but just the fact that somebody was rude to me, the conduct of the public service, for the public servant, in other words, gets reported. I have been waiting for this particular service for such a long time. They report those through the National Anti-Corruption Hotline as well. But those kinds of complaints were not anticipated at the time of the establishment of the hotline. But the majority, of course, remain those that relate to corruption allegations. What we do, in addition to following up on the allegations that are reported through the hotline, is that we also produce trends reports which indicate the number of complaints lodged, their origin, nature, and extent, where we assess them and give us a painted picture of what is actually happening in terms of the report on allegations of corruption. What are the areas of risk that are being highlighted, and so on. We'll also continue with the reporting on financial misconduct in the public service. This is a requirement in terms of the Public Finance Management Act that departments will have to report to the Public Service Commission annually on their finalized cases of financial misconduct. So that information gets provided to the Public Service Commission, we analyze it, and annually release a report which indicates the trends, what kinds of cases of financial misconduct were reported, what kinds of functions were meted out, and so on. Just to emphasize also that what we started doing in this area as well is that, because in the past you would have departments which simply submit what they call a nil report, which means we didn't have any finalized case of financial misconduct during this particular year. And we'll use that as a basis for the final report that we produce. What we do at the moment is then to take those departments that have submitted nil reports and do on-site verification, where we say, well, we've now come to confirm if indeed you didn't have any cases of financial misconduct that we finalized during this particular period. So that we are doing as part of just strengthening our oversight methodology there. A second area in this program of integrity and anti-corruption is that of professional ethics. And here we just reflect in terms of the number of cases coming through the National Anti-Corruption Hotline. But perhaps a key issue to keep emphasizing here, even which will become even more important when we go into the period ahead, is the severe strain with regards to the investigative capacity in departments, because you report those cases, and if you look at the figure there, 7,185 cases, we have received feedback on 2,567 cases, of which only 1,247 cases have been closed. So that gives a sense that there are still a lot of cases that were reported through the National Anti-Corruption Hotline that were referred to departments for follow-up and investigation, which departments have yet to finalize. So the capacity for such investigation is very paramount in the period that we face. We just flag also in the our medium-term strategic plan that where investigations have been conducted successfully, you have seen disciplinary action being taken against officials. We have seen sanctions such as dismissal being imposed, and we have seen money being recovered as well in the act of emanating from those cases of corruption that were dealt with through the National Anti-Corruption Hotline. Obviously, more can be recovered if the investigative capacity can be strengthened, because we'll have more cases being investigated. We also continue to play a strategic role in the fight against corruption, and we believe that going forward, a critical area will be strengthening our internal processes of the investigation of cases. Here, we'll be focusing during this medium-term period on rolling out a web-enabled system for the NABH that we have developed during the 9-10 financial year. Also, we see ourselves not only referring the allegations and the cases to departments, but taking up some of them ourselves and investigating them, obviously within the constraints of the limited capacity that the Public Service Commission has. Also, to enhance the scrutiny of the financial disclosure forms, the financial disclosure forms get lodged with the Public Service Commission annually. We will also look at the feasibility and potential value of lifestyle audit. At the moment, once the financial disclosure forms have been submitted to the Public Service Commission, the first step that we do is to take stock to say, have all senior managers submitted their financial disclosure forms? We take stock, and we then immediately communicate with the executive authorities to say, in your department, you have 100 senior managers, for example, but we've only received 60 financial disclosure forms. This is the number of managers and their names as well, who, according to our records, have not submitted their financial disclosure forms. Our recommendation is that you take disciplinary action against these managers. That is the first step. But the second step is the scrutiny itself, where we go into the content of the financial disclosure forms to scrutinize them, and where we identify areas of concern. For example, because we do also cross-check with the deed office, we cross-check with CIPRO, the CIPRO database, where we see that there are certain interests that have not been declared, that should have been declared, we bring those to the attention of the executive authority. Even where disclosures have been made, but where, in our opinion, there may be potential conflicts of interest, given the nature of the work of that particular manager, we bring those to the attention of the member of the executive. But the next step now is to say, can we strengthen this further by looking at this concept of lifestyle audit? As a start, it's really just conducting research on it, understanding how it works, understanding its value, understanding its feasibility in the context of the public service in South Africa. We also, as secretariat to the National Anti-Corruption Forum, as members know, a forum comprising business, civil society, and government, brought together to collectively fight against corruption. Our role in this forum and secretariat also extends to the implementation of the National Anti-Corruption Program, where the forum itself identifies certain activities, certain projects that must be undertaken, and with the PSC being responsible to make sure that those programs do indeed get implemented. There is a critical project here that we will facilitate, which is that of developing a national integrity system emanating from a resolution that was taken at the last National Anti-Corruption Forum, that a national integrity system must be developed so that it can be further debated, strengthened to improve the state of professional ethics in the country. That's the project that the PSC will continue. But in addition to that, we have over the years been identifying a province at a time where we assess the state of professional ethics in that province. We've done that in the Free State, we've done that in KZN, we've done that in Limpopo, we're now completing it in the Western Cape. During this particular period, we'll be looking at the Northwest province. And we take a wide range of indicators to assess the state of professional ethics in that province. Which we believe is another useful oversight tool that the executive and parliament can use. Moving now to the finances, the medium-term expenditure framework estimate for the period ahead, they organize according to the four programs that I have mentioned: administration, leadership and management practices, monitoring and evaluation, integrity, and anti-corruption, starting with the administration at 67 million during the first year, going up to 73, and then 76 in the outlying year, and leadership and management practices at 21 million, going up to 23 in the outlying year, and monitoring and evaluation starting off with 21 million during the 10-11 financial year, increasing to 24 million during the outlying year. The total figures at the bottom, 133 million for the first year, increasing to 145 million, and then 151 million in the last year of this medium-term expenditure period. The same figures, but this time not organized according to programs, this time organized according to economic classification, compensation of employees, goods and services, transfers and payment for capital assets, just to show where the how the figures are allocated according to those items of economic classification. Perhaps just to emphasize here, as part of this slide, that the resources have been reduced over this period by 1.951 million, 3 million, and 5 million over this period as a result of the deterioration of the current global economic environment and the domestic economic outlook. So the increases, therefore, from one year to the next are very marginal. Just to flag on some of the key contextual challenges that we face in relation to the resource issue, as a knowledge-based organization, our work tends to be labor-intensive, but with these restrictions and limitations in terms of resources, this places a strain on the scope of oversight work that the Public Service Commission can undertake. Just to illustrate there that the over the past medium term expenditure framework period, the average growth of the PSC's budget has been 7.7%, and with the PSC not receiving additional funding for the next medium term expenditure framework. If you're trying to illustrate that in terms of per capita, the staff number of staff members in the Public Service Commission relative to the number of public servants, it's basically one staff member for every plus minus 5,000. Public servant, and at this stage we're still excluding local sphere of government. But we'll say I'll say a bit about this area, but just to illustrate the nature of the challenge here, we have put measures in place to do more with less. We have reduced the number of outputs on the work plan. We have standardized evaluation frameworks. We have tried to make maximum use of the staff that's available, but in some instances it is just necessary to do some of this work at a larger scale. If you look at the transversal monitoring and evaluation system that we apply, for example, we take on average about 20 departments per annum, and out of 146 departments, if you take 20 departments per annum and apply that system in only 20 departments, it is really a small sample. And what is worse is that what we're doing with the system is that after a period of about 2-3 years, we want to apply that system again in the departments that we have assessed already to look at how they have improved since the last time we applied the system. Now, if you do 20, 21, 22 departments per annum, it will take you long to complete all the departments in the public service, let alone even be able to go back to them to assess how they have improved. Over there. So some of this work is just necessary to increase the scale, to increase the sample, and so on. So this budgetary and human resource limitations do indeed affect the scrutiny reach of the Public Service Commission. I did talk about the issue of local government, the advent of a single public service as envisaged in the Public Administration Bill. This one will have very profound implications for the Public Service Commission, because the expectation is that the oversight work of the Public Service Commission will now expand to the sphere of local government as well. So in addition to the 140-something departments, you're adding 284 municipalities, and you say the Public Service Commission, with its current resources, must expand its scrutiny reach to cover this municipality. It's just going to be difficult for that to be achieved. So it will definitely result in a significant increase in the work of the Public Service Commission. In this medium-term strategic plan, what we have tried to do is to take small steps as the Public Service Commission to begin to go into the area of local government, to understand what are the frameworks that are applicable to local government, what are the challenges, and so on. So you saw some of the projects that I have mentioned in the main program that we're beginning to do work in the area of local government. But if we are going to do serious oversight work at the area of local government, this will not be possible if there aren't substantial additional budgetary resources being made to the Public Service Commission. We also not limiting the work of the commission within the country. The chairperson in his opening remarks talked about the Association for African Public Services Commission, which brings together public service commissions and civil service commissions in the African continent, in this association whose formation was facilitated by the South African Public Service Commission. The chairperson of the South African Public Service Commission, I was appointed as the first president of this association, and we as the Office of the Public Service Commission are the secretariat. We believe that the establishment of the association has been achieved at an incredible pace, and we are confident that this will actually be a very useful platform for this organization, these institutions across the continent, to share experiences, to share lessons, and use those as a springboard to improve public administration in their respective countries. This obviously has capacity implications for the Public Service Commission as well. This medium-term strategic plan, honorable members, is in line with the estimate of public expenditure prescribed by National Treasury. We believe we have in the past managed to achieve more with less beyond our actual capacity, but with all these new developments now, including near the level of local government, we believe this will not be sustainable. In going forward, we will need to look at the extent to which the resort constraints can be addressed if the Public Service Commission is to perform its function effectively as required by the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I open for any questions or comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to thank the presenter for a very comprehensive overview. I always find it of great value, those presentations by the Public Service Commission. It's a resource to this committee, and I think we make use of them quite a lot. We rely on them extensively. I certainly do, and I'm convinced many of my colleagues on this committee too. There are a couple of items that I just want to need further elaboration or clarification, or possibly just a comment from you. Firstly, the National Anti-Corruption Hotline. You've got that, but we now also have an inter-ministerial task team on anti-corruption task team, and we have the presidential hotline dealing with service delivery problems. And surely they all have to coordinate with each other, otherwise we find people doing the same things, overlapping and so on. I'm just wondering, isn't that creating more admin to coordinate, and how do you do it, and now you need more staff just to coordinate it, so it also has financial implications? What is the state of play regarding the interaction or coordination between these various hotlines and various task teams that now exist? That was the first question. The second question, you mentioned, you know, that you are going to provide names of offenders regarding non-disclosure of interest, and I suppose maybe also with the not signing of contracts, service contracts. Now, I think I want to encourage you very strongly to do that. I think it's excellent. You know, often we get a very comprehensive report, but it gives us tables and graphs, and we can see how many people that are supposed from senior management service are required to make their financial interest, but they don't. But we don't know who they are, so it stays anonymous. But I must say the public is sick and tired of senior public officials getting away with murder and wasting the taxpayers' money, spending it inappropriately. And it's time that we take the kid gloves off and we become much, much tougher with these people. We must take action now. It's enough talk, enough committees, enough strategies, another integrity commission or another ethics committee. Time is over for this kind of thing. And I want to ask that we, as a committee, also are provided with the names of those offending people so we can make recommendations in Parliament to the executive about dealing with these people. But it's time that they are exposed. So that's a very sincere request from my side. I hear very much a plea regarding the budget, and I must say certainly from our side we have a sympathetic ear for this, because the Public Service Commission is doing very good work and they're helping us in the fight against corruption. That's one of the biggest challenges that the civil service is facing, fighting corruption. If we don't eradicate this scourge, we're not going to deliver services. And it's always the poorest of the poor who suffer the most. So really, we must be very sympathetic, and it's also a plea to my colleagues in this committee that we give a very sympathetic ear to this plea, and we must strengthen their resources. But a further word of warning in this regard is that I think it comes from the Public Service Commission itself with regard to the proposed single public service. That would require it will be more demanding of their time, more demanding of the human, the manpower, more demanding of their budget. Can we afford it at this stage? So that's just a warning signal about that proposed single public service. Madam Chairman, Madam Chairperson, the last point is a request to the single to the Public Service Commission, not something that came up in this report now, but something that I just want to raise, and I don't see another opportunity. The availability of your reports. Now, I've mentioned this before. This report that we're going to deal with today has been circulated to us a week or two, 3 weeks possibly ago. So we've had time to study it, and now we come prepared to this meeting. But it doesn't always happen. Sometimes we read about reports in the newspapers, but we as MPs, as parliamentarians, haven't seen those reports. Now, I'm not sure where the problem is. Maybe you submit it to Parliament, and it's Parliament that doesn't distribute it to its members. I'm not sure. But I raise it here, Madam Chair, so maybe we can take it up at parliamentary level to see that once these reports are released, that they are distributed to our, to us as members of this portfolio committee straight away. I want to give an example. Towards the end of last year, there was a big controversy about the appointment of the Director General of Justice. He was involved or implicated in the Jinwana Commission of Inquiry. And the Public Service Commission did an investigation into this person. And there was a report. And the report had been submitted to the Cabinet. But we, as members of Parliament, have not seen that report, although the media was aware of this report. And they quoted from this report, but we haven't seen it. And I would like to ask that this shouldn't happen again. We should see those reports in the first instance. That's part of our, it helps us. It's part of the equipment we need to do our oversight jobs properly. Thank you very much for this opportunity, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Anjumukhe. I think also to add to that is the fact that this issue of reports coming into the committee to take a particular trend, it will also assist us as a committee, I think, to be able to be focused on the types of oversight visits that we do. Because very often we find that we do oversights, but we do not really target the key areas that we're supposed to be targeting in terms of problems related to public service and administration. And I think that's also one of my points that I wanted to actually get an indication as to, you do these investigations, you do these researches, what happens to all those reports and statistics and so on. There's no indication as to a way forward thereafter. You've spent this money, you've done these investigations, you've found, you have these findings of research work done, but what happens after that in terms of us having really the improved service delivery that we're talking about? It's just a word for thought. Okay. Honorable Russell? Oh, is it honorable? Yeah, honorable Russell.
Acting Chairperson, thank you very much. Just three broad areas that I wanted to raise. I think on the introduction, the appointment simultaneously of both a new chairperson as well as a deputy chairperson. The Public Service Commission says that they've treated it as a milestone to improve the work of the Public Service Commission. I would have wondered whether it should not have been a milestone to fundamentally, in a sense, review what the Public Service Commission does, given there's a newness in leadership in the commission itself. Secondly, that there is also within the presidency a planning and a monitoring and evaluation capacity that that could have led to a reordering of and the farming out of the work that could be done there, but more importantly, in the face of declining budgets, which I've spoken about. I think we can be lobbied for additional budget, but at the end of the day, I think the Public Service Commission has to play with the hand it's been dealt, and that hand is a declining budget, and that's a good reason to fund it. So I think that the first one is that I don't think it's a lost opportunity, but I think one could, for example, see what is a further strengthening of the niche work of the Public Service Commission that it could be done. The second thing that I thought was important in terms of that budget is that if you do a very rough calculation, then 76% of the Public Service Commission's budget goes to staff, goes to personnel-related expenditure. And while I take the point that it is knowledge-intensive and therefore person-driven, I think a further breakdown of that staff would say how much of that budget goes to, in a sense, your knowledge-related expertises that are brought in to improve the efficacy of the work of the public service of the Public Service Commission. So that's the second broad area that I thought could be fairly useful. And then I think, thirdly, if you go to slide number 4 on page 2, it would also have been very useful if across those 4 programs that's presented on slide number 4, it would have been useful to see how that budget is in a sense balanced across those 4 programs, because then we could see whether the Public Service Commission is, we know what it says, but is it putting its money where its mouth is? Is it, in a sense, for example, giving equitable, not equal, but equitable resources to program number 3 that deals with service delivery improvements and all of those kinds of things? Is it doing that? Or how does it balance its money across? Because we could all leave here with a perception that the heavy thing about the Public Service Commission is its ethical and anti-corruption drive, but you may find that there's very little money going into it, and therefore the efficacy of that intervention is not as strong. So I thought that in us trying to hold to some account the Public Service Commission, we need to be equipped with far more detailed information that allows us to see where does it put its money. We know what it says, but how is its money apportioned across those programmatic areas? I thought those are 3 points that I just wanted to make, Jefferson.
Thank you, Andrew Russell. Andrew Pascal.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to ask a very short question. I'm covered as far as the others are concerned. In connection with the satisfaction of the levels of citizens, can you please give us an indication to what this level of satisfaction at the moment is, and then what are those key drivers? I think you mentioned 8. Drivers. What are the key drivers you're applying to determine what the satisfaction level is? Thank you very much.
Honorable Muhale.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question will be on the 5th slide where you are saying about 563 grievances were referred to PSC, of which 336 were not considered to be of merit. And my question would be, what is really happening here? Is there someone who's not doing his work who has to follow procedures in taking disciplinary actions or whatever? Because if they are sent to you where someone would have done his work in the department, then what happens? Or is it a problem of capacity? And my question also would be coming to the satisfaction levels. Who is doing the satisfaction levels? Are you doing it on your own, or do you go to the department, the concerned department, to say you do take out maybe a questionnaire or whatever? They do the satisfaction levels, and is it really a true reflection of the satisfaction levels? And my other question is on the recruitment of senior managers at local government level. Are you able to assist in that regard? The other question is, with concerns the signing of the performance agreement, whether there's this notion that there's other managers will be saying, we go to the strategic planning first, then we come back and sign performance agreement. So what is happening here? Can we get a clarification on that? Thank you.
Thank you. I think one of them. Okay, can we take Mr. Ramakaka?
Thank you very much, Chair, and I think a good presentation. I have just about two or three questions, too. The one is the question around the issue of grievances. There's something that you talk about HODs, how they are dealt with, a mechanism to submit their grievances. Now, there you spoke about, and you still have to finalize that process, as I understand. My question is really, how do you then intervene where there is a HODs who probably has serious grievances in terms of resolving it? For an example, let me make an example. The HOD of correctional services, will he come to you after the other processes is not necessarily bearing the fruit? Given the independence of the Public Service Commission, where the person believed that injustice has been done in terms of my work, in terms of my relationship with the head or political head. So that's where the question I'm asking. What then happened in the current period where you have not really finalized that particular issue? The second question for me is I was listening that perhaps you would say something about Arastato and how we deal with this issue in terms of public service, in terms of the service they also provide. But if you look in the Constitution, I think Section 195 that you referred to, public enterprise is mentioned in there. But when you talk about strategy and dealing with strategic plan, maybe say something about it. I want to hear because I want to link this with the issue about professionalism and ethics. How you deal with the financial disclosure in the public service generally, and how does the disclosure extend to the parastatal or public enterprise, for an example. What is the thinking, what is the strategic thinking around that particular issue? Because you may think that the only limited into what we see in front of us, whereas more money and more conflict may be happening in the public enterprise sphere as well, but without necessarily putting the eyes to it. So I just want to find out what is the strategic view around that issue. One can make a lot of examples around the parastatal and the issue of disclosure and this whole web of interest and conflict of interest, particularly around the issues of tenders, etc. So how do you deal with that? The last question is this issue about lifestyle audit. And you said somewhere in the slide that you are going to do a research. Quite interesting the way they use research to find out how to go about it. And I think if I'm correct, some public service is already happening. If you look at how the police are dealt with in terms of the lifestyle audit and their involvement, whether there is involvement in the organized crime, that is already operational. There is a way to check the police officers who are dealing with this particular organized crime, whether their lifestyle in terms of what they earn, in terms of what they have, is in fact telling. So I'm just wondering whether this process is not stretching the target, putting the target out of reach when there is an outcry around the issue of the lifestyle audit, particularly insofar as state officials is concerned. Does it need a research, and if it does, how long this research should be when the topic itself is stale in terms of the debate? It's been repeated over and over again. Now at the end of the process, then we're going to do the research. I'm quite worried about the way. Maybe you'll explain what the research means and the time frame towards the implementation, because this is actually a body that is a constitutionally created body who's got really has to move on its own. So those are a few questions I wanted just to get a clarity. Sure, thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Muhali. Or is it Honorable Mulek? You had a question, I think. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. On the issue of this suspension in the public service, this issue of suspension is serious. It has cascaded also to the municipalities. You find in the office 4 to 5 people are in a suspension with pay. And this issue is the one that makes service delivery to be slow. So I was saying the public service on their monitoring, they must also focus on this issue. And then also the issue of, we were complaining last time on the issue of acting directors and acting managers in our public services. I was going to say, how do the public service advise the department on how to deal with these issues? Thank you.
Thank you. I think I've covered everyone who wanted to ask a question. Okay, before we get answers from the Public Service Commission, I think I'd also just like to add that I also have a concern in terms of the models that we're having and the research work. And if there's any particular budget allocation in terms of the work that you're doing. But I already asked earlier on, but I'm bothered about the fact that you have this research work done, you have these investigations done, but there's no publicity or indication as to where do these end or what is done about that. Because it's also another way of us being able to measure improvements in terms of public service delivery. Then the other issue is, these conferences that you have and gatherings or whatever you want to call them, I think it's time that we also, as a committee, should be seen doing things differently. We should actually be part of this. I'm not saying that we must be a special guest or anything, but we should be seen to be part of these gatherings or conferences, because then it puts us on par in terms of what needs to be done in the public service or what is being done to improve matters of the public service. And most of all, I think sometime last year, the commission did give us a presentation on the issue of vacancies. There was a research or investigation done in terms of vacancies in the public service. How well is that incorporated into your improving issues of closing the gaps on acting positions? And how best are we able to also find ways of saving money on this issue of people who are acting in positions? Okay, can't respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's really a big spectrum of a large spectrum of questions and comments. At some stage, I thought we would stop for the second set of questions, but we continue, Madam Chair. So I think that we need to be deliberate and slow in answering them and toing and froing, because I think when the questions are many, then some of the items escape your mind and you remember them a little later. But we will give it a try. I think from a strategic point,
I would like to deal, I think, with the issues that surround the remodeling of the Public Service Commission. I think it has a member of Rasool and one or two other members that are looking at repositioning of the organization. Yes, indeed. I mean, the environment in which we operate as the Public Service Commission is continually changing. And the resources is part of the influence, the lack of resources, but also the restructuring in government in general, the global crisis, also influences it. But one must bear in mind as well that developments like happen in the presidency, they happen and they are welcomed by the Public Service Commission, especially in the area of planning and monitoring and evaluation. Because for some time now we have lamented the fact that there isn't enough monitoring capacity within their government. So that has been, you know, very much welcomed. The idea also of prioritizing, because one must remember that government is prioritizing, has got specific priorities. And in the instance of monitoring and evaluation, we are really talking about monitoring outcomes in a chosen, you know, few areas. And also one must bear in mind in terms of the mandate, the separation of the powers, in terms of what the role of Parliament is, or the role of the Public Service Commission, which strengthens the oversight function of Parliament. So given that scenario, one would definitely say that there will always be a need of monitoring and evaluation, which is embedded in all work of government, not only targeting outcomes and also targeting a particular area. So I think one must bear in mind that there will always be that need. Now, in the sense that resources are not forthcoming, but the mandate is increasing, both in terms of the sphere of local government and in terms of the content and the demands of stakeholders, you will find that continuously the Public Service Commission has to be asking the question and remodeling its work accordingly. But I think one first gets to, you know, to a limit, because if you look at all those programs of the Commission, you will find that you know, if you decrease the resources, then there is thinning of the emphasis rather than deepening of the work that needs to be done. Now, this is exactly what the Commission is being asked to do in terms of local government, and when that bill becomes law, because that would mean that the Public Service Commission relooks at how it does its work. You might find that some elements of programs drop away because of the sheer numbers that one has to deal with. So those exercises, I think, are up and coming. We are welcoming the support, I think, for our plea to have the budget of the Commission increased. We also are, and I think we would be coming not very much far in the future, to the committee for more support in very concrete ways in which we put the suggestions on how, in fact, the Public Service Commission can be self-sufficient in being able to carry its mandate. So I think that those debates should be ongoing. Also, the examination of how we spend in each one of the programs is part of what is there already. We can tell you, and in fact, in the next interaction that we have, we can give you a sense of how much, or in fact, even as we sit here, our CFO is here, can give you figures, a breakdown of what how much we spend in this program. And I can tell you now that it is evenly spread across the program, because we, up to now, we have been emphasizing and saying, okay, all these areas are part of our mandate, and therefore we need to be doing justice to them. But like I said earlier, this is going to quickly change when the resources are not forthcoming, and yet the scope and the area of operation of the Commission is increasing. So I think that those should be, in my view, ongoing interactions in which we are able to interact with you, so that we get your compliance, your support in terms of those initiatives. We're welcoming, I said, the recognition of the work of the commission. I think it was Member Scott Green was mentioning the recognition of the work of the commission and also the support for the budget. Now, does the creation of an interministerial committee on corruption, the presidential hotline, do they create more administration and bureaucracy and create more expenditure? And what has been the commission's approach to them? I think if one looks at the Interministerial Committee on Corruption, I think that one should recognize that corruption remains the number one problem, an area that it needs to be dealt with in South Africa very severely. So as a commission, we welcome all the measures that the executive takes in curbing corruption. And as we said in the presentation, the Public Service Commission plays a role and is a secretariat in the National Anti-Corruption Forum. And we see, therefore, a committee of this nature, relating directly in the representation of government within the National Anti-Corruption Forum. As we mentioned earlier, the forum is composed of a business, government and civil society. So any strengthening of the government or the public sector arm of the National Anti-Corruption Forum should be welcomed, and we look forward, as we speak on the 16th, there will be an executive committee meeting of the National Anti-Corruption Forum, and it is in this interaction that we think that there should be sharing of ideas across those sectors, including, in fact, suggestions that come intersectorally on how to deal with business, how to deal with civil society, what are the responsibilities of civil society, are the endeavors that are being put by the public sector and the executive, are they enough in the eyes of business, and vice versa. So I think we welcome these measures in that spirit. In terms of the presidential hotline, I think last year we did report to you how we continued in its founding, and also up to now, how we continue to interact and strengthen each of the hotlines as the need arises. And one must remember that also the Public Service Commission holds the National Anti-Corruption Hotline on the request of the executive, and it does coincide with the mandate of the commission. I did say, Madam Chair, there are so many questions that they escape your mind. Now, the other question, I think, for me that is interesting, that we must also stay with, is this one of the reports of the Public Service Commission. On the one hand, there is the recognition that the Public Service Commission reports are not readily available to the committee or members of parliament. And on the other hand, the comments that the reports and the recommendations of the Public Service Commission, what happened to them? Why aren't actions being taken on the reports of the commission? I think these problems and these areas were brought before into this committee, Madam Chair, for us to look at, and also in line with the mandate of the commission. The commission reports to parliament, and that's the business of the commission, and we do that without fear. We table all these reports. There is none of these reports and its recommendations that we don't table to parliament. We table them with the speaker of this parliament. We table them with the speakers of all the legislatures throughout the country. We do that very, very religiously. Otherwise, we would not exist if we did not do that. However, having said that, it then becomes the responsibility of these legislatures, how they deal with the reports. And I think that those matters should be matters that each one of the legislatures tackle. I was last week addressing a similar committee in the legislature of Gauteng, and we did discuss the reports of the commission. We concluded that when we're tabling the reports, there should be fewer copies, but whenever we make presentations, we should come with the copies as we did to this committee today. But also we discussed ways and means in which the recommendations of the commission can be strengthened. And one of those recommendations was that having presented the recommendations to the legislation, it is incumbent that the committee in which we present should ensure that they present to the larger legislature so that they become part and parcel of the resolution of the legislature. So once there are resolutions of the legislature, then, Madam Chair, it should be common knowledge that they would be, they should at least theoretically be implemented by the departments that they have targeted. On its side, the Public Service Commission, as you heard in the presentation, does summon heads of departments or managers, does inspect service delivery, points, and still makes recommendations. We do get the information for when we need it and when we think it's very urgent that we get it. We get that information, we do the inspections. But finally, we must boil it down to a report and recommendations, which must be presented to our stakeholders and for our stakeholders to facilitate. So I'm saying, Madam Chair, let's stay with this area and not necessarily complete it today, but let's at some stage reach some conclusion in terms of how really we're going to deal with these reports and what needs to be done, including the availability of reports. I think that the Public Service Commission can make reports available with your guidance, Madam Chair. How should we improve the reports being made available? Okay, I've already dealt with the questions on the programs and how the resources are allocated to each one of them, so we may hear a bit more of that in today or in the future. Are the citizen satisfaction that we are conducting, are they a true reflection of the satisfaction of citizens? Yeah, I think this is a $1 million question. I think that every researcher, every student is striving to ensure that this is what happens. We're always looking, as researchers and as people in the field, to make sure that we actually get to the heart of that matter. But I don't think anybody can say that this is an area that has been perfected such that one could say that each and every satisfaction survey that you have or endeavor will reflect the true picture. That is why we speak of the citizen satisfaction drivers, because we're continuously trying to improve the methodology so that it reflects exactly what the citizens feel. The area of grievances also has been an area in which we've got a number of questions, and we could stay with those as well because there's quite a lot there that we need to deal with. You see, when the regulations are implemented, they are already a product of a bargaining in the bargaining council. There is an acceptance that these are the regulations. This is how we're going to deal with the grievance. And it is in that light, therefore, that the 60 days, that is given when a person has been suspended, it is enough time, it is felt. It is enough time to prepare a case and have hearing by the end of that 60 days, so that no one is prejudiced, so that no more resources are spent unnecessarily. So that is the intention and the spirit of the law. In addition, there is also given room that with mutual agreement, these 60 days can be prolonged, depending on how complex that particular case is. For us in the Public Service Commission, we regard that state of affairs as very much adequate in terms of the law and the regulations themselves. It is fair. It complies to the Constitution. It complies to reasonableness. So that is the status quo. But as with the other fields of human resources that we have always emphasized to this committee, there is non-compliance. Sometimes people just don't do what they're supposed to do. Then you get into more expenditure. You get people being suspended, over months, over years, where they are getting paid. So there is lack, in fact, of a commitment in terms of the process that needs to be applied, because, as I said, 60 days is long enough when you know that something has happened here for you to work your case and be able to hold the hearings at the end of that. So no amount, I think, of engineering the framework and the legislation, in our view, is going to bring about the results that we're looking for. But like I said, we can stay with that with those grievances, and we can perhaps debate them further. And the reason why you have precautionary suspension is because you don't want the person to interfere with the evidence that you might want to bring forth from the department or from their unit, wherever they are. So you have to suspend them so that you have a free hand in gathering the information, because the person may dabble with the information that is there and make your case unworkable. So if there is any area that needs to be discussed, we need to do it. Now, in so far as the parastatals or the entities, there was a question, I think, from Member Ramatakane there that what about the entities? What integrity systems do they have? I think entities are not the only area in which the Public Service Commission has got big question marks. Even the local government. We that's why we have welcomed and supported the endeavors of the Public Administration Management Bill that open up possibilities for ethics, for integrity in local government, for all the systems that would ensure that we have a credible and system there. So is the case with entities. So that is why the commission has been looking at its mandate and has been having legal opinions on them. And that is why you have the Public Administration Management Bill. So it is areas that the commission has not previously looked at, and it is the areas that we think the Public Service Commission can add a lot of value in terms of these systems that you see have been perfected in terms of the combinations and in terms of the oversight function that we have done or continue to do at both provincial level and national level. So both areas, local government and entities, are areas that I think we need to ensure, because all these are areas of public administration, and there's no reason why they should lag behind in terms of the systems that need to be brought in order to make them also critical institutions. I think the other comments, I think, are very supportive comments in terms of the reasoning why we are doing studies or doing research on the reasons of suspension without pay, the reasons for decreased service delivery as a result of some of the bad or inadequate human resource practices, including the people that are expected to act for long periods, on which we have made recommendations, we have reports, and we have made recommendations to the committee and other committees. I think I've dealt with the area of the research model, Madam Chair, and the area of what we do with the reports of the commission and their recommendations. Also, on your comments on the conferences, I think that indeed, I think the Public Service Commission recognizes the role of the legislature and parliament, and that in all these conferences we need to invite and also share our ideas with the parliament. We already do so, you will recall, in the labor relations summit, we invite the legislature. We do invite you in a number of conferences. So I think it is in that spirit that we welcome your suggestions, and we take them very seriously. Going forward, I am sure that there are many areas and many questions that I've not dealt with. As I said, the spectrum is long, but we can stay with the areas. But before more questions, I see the hands from members for more questions. Before those, Madam Chair, can I plead, because I've left, I'm sure, a number of areas, especially the technical areas, I think, that have been raised in terms of why we do certain research and why not the other one. I think, can we let my deputy and the director general and our chief financial officer tackle any one of the questions that that I've skipped, or any one of the ones that I've not done as much justice as I should have. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Before the Director General lets me pressing issues, Honorable Dreyer from Honorable Russell.
It's not a new question, it's just reminding the Commissioner. I asked about publicizing the names of offenders, especially with their non-compliance to disclosure of interest and signing performance contracts. We want to know who these people are.
Yes. Honorable Russell, you also had a pressing issue.
Just very quickly, so that if the DG or the deputy wants to pick up on it, I think that my question is that there's something too equal about the distribution of that budget across the four programs. It doesn't say we are putting our money into this area where we think we will make the most difference. When it is 21, 21, 22, then you begin to wonder, is this just an equal distribution of the resources? I would think, for example, if you're saying we want to have a niche, we want to make sure that service delivery is improved over the next 12 months. That's our main strategic objective, and then we have other objectives. Then you say, let us take some from here and some from here, and let's bolster that program. On the other hand, you could try and deal with anti-corruption across the board and make no impact. You could say, we think that corruption is worse at this sphere of government level. Let's put our resources there. We could say that it is worse in supply chain management practices, so let's focus there. We could say that it is worse in this province, so let's focus there. What I'm not getting a sense of is how you are using declining budgets to try and make the most impact on the indicative factors that tell you. We could go on chasing clerks and so forth for corruption and ignore chief directors who sit at the top of tender processes. So why don't we say, let the clerks get the implications of the fear factor when we go after the chief directors. I'm just saying, otherwise you're going to spread the money so equally and so thinly that you could be toothless at the end of the day. I just wanted to clarify that point.
Thank you, Honorable Russell. Can you?
Just welcome the comments of the member Russell. That indeed, I think these are the kind of the comments that we welcome, and that also the role of this committee is to point to those directions as well. To say, in the view of the Parliament or this committee, this is an important exercise. That kind of exercise is already taking place. Maybe not across the program, but within programs. Within the program, there is already a deliberate, as you heard the presentation, a deliberate choice of areas that we think are strategic, that are have to make a big difference. I mean, later today, we are going to be talking about the supply chain management, which is less than 200,000 rand. I mean, one would say, no, that's too little. Why not concentrate on the big ones? But we feel the opposite. We feel that, like the saying goes, it says, penny wise, pound foolish. If you take care of the pennies, the shillings, and the pounds, take care of them. So that strategy there. So I think that it is this kind of input that we're looking for from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think we also need to also look at the fact that I think part of the budget, which is thrown into vote 11 for the Public Service Commission leave, could also affect our lobbying for more funds. So perhaps that's another area of thought for us. Okay, can we have a response then from the DG before break for tea?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the opportunity. Just I would like again to pick up on the point that Honorable Russell is raising, the point of focusing on specific areas so that we spend our budget where the agency is. I just would like to say strategically as the Commission, we are always aware that the mandate of the Commission is very broad. We try to strike a balance, and it's really a difficult balance to strike when you don't have the resources. If you leave the rest of the Commission's mandate, who are you leaving it to? you know, obviously when you focus, there will be other things that will be falling through the cracks. So for the commission, it's actually being caught between a rock and a hard place to try to play that balance of zooming in on the pressing issues, at the same time satisfying the broad mandate of the Public Service Commission as it flows from the Constitution. But the comments, as the chairperson has said, are very welcome. I also would like to go back to the issue of citizen satisfaction surveys. I'm sensing from the questions, you know, people are saying, do you really go there? Yes, we go there. We don't outsource citizen satisfaction surveys. It's the officials of the OPSC who go out on the field and actually do those citizen satisfaction surveys. But I'm also sensing here that people perhaps are actually making an outcry. And I think I have a sense that probably it's about our sample. We sample according to our resources. If you talk of an institution such as Statistics South Africa, they will do 30,000 households and give you results of a particular survey. Obviously, the validity there is very high. We have very limited samples, but, honorable members, our samples are informed by our resources. Okay? I think the one area that was raised by member Ramataka was the area of what do we do currently with the grievances of heads of departments. What we do actually is we function within the ambit of the grievance rules at the present moment. And the grievance rules at the present moment say the grievances must be resolved as close as possible to the point of origin. So currently, when an HOD has a grievance, the grievance has at least to go to the office of the Premier, to the Premier of a particular province, or at national level to the Presidency. And it has to be addressed there. But the Commission does conduct follow-up, you know, to say there was a grievance that emanated from such and such an HOD or a number of HODs. We go back to the sources where the grievance was referred, to the places where the grievances were referred, to say, what have you done about the grievance? But within the ambit of the rules as they stand currently, we take the matters as close as possible to the point of origin, and the point of origin in the provinces, those would be the Premier's offices. But ideally, we want to move to a situation where HODs can lodge their grievances directly with the Public Service Commission. It's okay, thanks.
And, Chairperson, just to quickly look at two or three of the questions. The Honourable Dreyer raised the question about names of offenders and publicising them. What happens at the moment in our reports that we publish, we don't mention names. I think it's because at the time the report is compiled, the focus of the Public Service Commission is on the practice itself. The information on the names is available, that information gets made available to the executive, it gets made available to committees of parliament when they ask. But we don't include it in the report because then it makes the report very long. And I mean, it's about 80,000 rand to publish. So get that report published, and you have to make hundreds and hundreds of copies so that 500 can come to Parliament here, and then you have about 200 for each legislature and so on. So it makes it quite expensive. So we don't include the names in the published report, but those names are made available to the executive so that they can take action. And the names are also available to committees through their chairpersons when there is the information it's requested. Just also on this issue of the availability of reports, I think also I should also emphasize that we don't publish all our reports and table them in Parliament. They are, for example, public administration investigations, where there is a case in a particular department against a certain individual where we conduct an investigation, and that report is then submitted to the executive. Those kinds of reports, because of the resources like us, we don't publish them. And because we don't publish them, we end up also not taking them in Parliament. And I think the good example is the one that the Honourable Member had mentioned involving the former Director General of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, where such an investigation was done based on a request from the Minister. The Minister approached the Public Service Commission and said, I would like you to conduct this investigation. So we conducted the investigation and then submitted the report to the Minister. So these are our recommendations. Now, reports like those, we don't end up publishing, making several copies and taking them in Parliament. And that will explain why the Honourable Member is saying it the media knew about it before it was tabled in Parliament, because it wasn't tabled in Parliament, actually. And there are many of those kinds of public administration investigations where, in terms of our protocol for investigations, we get a request from the Minister, from the MEC, say, here's the practice I'm concerned about, please investigate, provide a report, and we do that. But our resources also don't permit us to publish all of them. Just the issue raised by the Honourable Van Kalkbrake as well, just to add on what our deputy chairperson has said around the satisfaction service. You see, the satisfaction service that we have been conducting thus far has been focusing on specific services. So we will say this year we focus on social services, social grants. The next year we focus on agricultural services, and then we focus on the criminal justice sector. Even within that sector, we'll identify specific services, not just do everything. So we have therefore not been able to say this is the general satisfaction level of citizens, because the studies were focused on specific services. So if you look at our report, they will tell you what was the satisfaction level when it comes to home affairs, when it comes to correctional services, when it comes to that kind of split. And I think if my memory serves me well, the studies we've done thus far, the lowest satisfaction levels were in correctional services at some point. We are at about 50-51% levels of satisfaction. But the issue that we always emphasize when it comes to citizen satisfaction studies is that the overall figure itself may be misleading. I remember the case here of Home Affairs where I think the overall satisfaction level was 61%, and the question was being raised, but can people really be that satisfied with Home Affairs? But if you go into the study itself and look at the issues the study looked at and unpack it in terms of what citizens said, you begin to see that people were actually happy with accessibility. Especially because certain Home Affairs offices now are open on Saturdays as well, whilst they were not in the past. People are happy with the information available, that you go to Home Affairs, there's a form, it's easy to read and so on and so on, and they express themselves based on that. But they're extremely unhappy with turnaround time, those kinds of things. So by just focusing on the overall figure, you actually miss the detail. And I can just also give the example of the South African police. When we conducted citizen satisfaction surveys there, you get people being happy with the general administration services at police stations. If you go to a police station because you want to have documents certified, you know, the service you get is excellent, it's very quick and so on. And people say, we are happy with that. But then if you go there because you want to report a crime, people are unhappy. But if you just look at the one figure and say, well, it's 50% or it's 62%, but you don't go into what were people happy with, what were they unhappy with, I think we end up then missing the message that you get through a citizen satisfaction survey. You're asking Honourable Van Kalkbrake about the key drivers that we are using. We've taken a combination of the Batubele principles and other drivers, and then we've said, let's go to citizens. Let's go to South African citizens and ask them, what do they find as the most important thing about their service? Is it about courtesy? Is it about timeliness? Is it about availability of information? And is it about redress, that if I don't get this promised level of service, that I'll get the public servant apologizing and saying, this is how we'll meet you halfway and make things good. So we listed over 10 of them. And then we went to service managers in departments and we said to them, what do you think about this? Do you think citizens will regard this as the most important drivers of their satisfaction in terms of public service delivery. We got feedback from service managers in departments. We wrote to every single department in the country. And the next step was to go to citizens themselves. That's what we have done during this financial year, and a report is coming out on this, where we said, well, let's throw this now to citizens, and let's see what they find as the most important drivers of their satisfaction. And it's very interesting. I mean, you're beginning to see that issues of timeliness, issues of rigorous, issues of courtesy are beginning to be flagged as much more important. Because what we'll be doing at the next level now, during this medium term, is to say, let's take those drivers that citizens rated highly, to say these are the most important drivers of our citizens' satisfaction level, and then we apply those consistently, year in, year out, to say, what are the levels of satisfaction? Are they improving or are they not improving? So the drivers, those are the kinds of drivers that we're using, timeliness, accessibility, courtesy, and so on and so on, guided by the white paper on the transformation of services. The white paper. I think just to also add the question of grievances, the Honorable Mohale asked, why is it that we have a high number of grievances that are being brought before the Public Service Commission without the internal procedures being exhausted? It's a combination of factors. Sometimes we have a public servant who themselves on their own, instead of lodging the grievance internally, just decide to approach the Public Service Commission. Sometimes it happens because of frustration, because the person has lost a grievance internally, and the 30 days that has been allocated expires. No feedback, and I'm not even being approached to say, by mutual agreement, let's see how we extend this day. It just expires and there is silence. So out of frustration, they then approach the Public Service Commission directly. In other instances, it's through their labor representatives that the person gets frustrated internally, they approach their labor representatives, and then the labor representative tries to deal with the department, no progress, and they come to the Public Service Commission. So it's a variety of factors that leads to cases being referred prematurely to the Public Service Commission. Are we able to assist when it comes to the recruitment of senior managers at local government level? Well, not in the executive function of the recruitment process itself. Because remember, where we come in terms of the oversight. So that's why the project that we have on the work plan, it's an assessment of how it is being done, the recruitment of senior managers at local level. What are the challenges? What are the prescripts? Are those prescripts being observed? And how the process can be strengthened and so on and so on. But we are not part of the very chain itself of recruiting and selecting managers at local level. The issue Honorable Mohale raised is about managers saying we have not signed performance agreements because we are waiting for strategic plans. Of course, strategic plans are the foundation because you contract according to what you have agreed to as a department that's what you're going to deliver on. So yes, they must be linked. You have a strategic plan, you then have an annual performance plan or work plan of the department, then you have a performance agreement. But the timing should be such that in terms of the policies, by the end of the first month of the financial year, the performance agreement must have been signed. So it means by that time your strategic plan must be in place and your work plan must be in place. So you can't say that it's May, I don't have a performance agreement because I'm still waiting for the strategic plan of the department to be finalized, which means you've gone into the financial year already. On what basis is the department functioning if the plan for the year is not in place? In terms of the requirements, the filing with the Public Service Commission is only by the end of June. So if by the end of June that information, that the performance agreement is not with the Public Service Commission, is not in place, you are already going into the middle of the financial year. What is the basis of holding the head of department accountable if that is not in place? The Honorable Ramasakane, the question about the lifestyle audit. I think the focus really for the Public Service Commission, the Public Service Commission would like to, when we go into an oversight process, we have an internal protocol which says what are the applicable principles, what are the steps that have to be taken in the Public Service Commission, in under what circumstances does the Public Service Commission conduct a lifestyle audit. And that's what we are talking about here. Because otherwise, if we just say, well, let's conduct a lifestyle audit, somebody will say, oh, I've seen how the police do it. Another person will say, well, I've seen how they do it in Canada. And we end up not having an accountable and consistent process within the Public Service Commission. So through which this is done. So that is really the purpose, to make sure that we get to that point where we are very clear as to what is the process that we have to follow as a commission, under what circumstances do we conduct an audit of this nature, so that at the end of the day we have our own protocol that we can then apply. It's not the issue of moving the target, but it's making sure that we have an internal accountable protocol that we can apply consistently as the commission. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we are having tightness in time. Let me allow you for a minute.
Thank you, Chair. I hate to do this. I think with respect to the response on the HOD grievances, they have forgotten to answer specific questions. I asked a question in relation to HOD or Director General of the Correctional Services. So you didn't talk about it. I wanted to know whether you, in all the processes that you followed, including the intervention when the other mechanism has failed, in this particular instance, have you done something about it? That's a question that I might have asked about it. The last thing that I didn't quite get clarity around is the reliability factor of the hotline, corruption hotline that you run, in terms of verification, the verification of information that you get. What would you say is 60-40 in terms of reliability? People will phone in and say, we are alleging or this is happening, and somebody who is sitting at that hotline will capture the information. It will go through the processing. So I'm asking, at the point of where you say the matter is semi-concluded, what is the reliability factor of that method of verification method that you have? Would we not see a name at the end of that process where the person's name is written, but actually it was just merely an allegation that has not been tested, or the method that we have tested has not produced results that is accurate? Let me ask this so differently. Somebody phones your office and say, I have seen Leonard carrying a bag of abalone. Right? That's something involving corruption.
So okay, you capture it. With your respect, but I think now you are going to the areas of scope. Maybe you could share that over tea, if you would allow me. I think it's an unfair question, but if they are willing to answer it, can we do that after tea? I'm just worried that our time is overlapping too far. Thank you. Quickly, 15 minutes, please. Otherwise, we won't be able to complete the second presentation. Okay, members, I think before we go on to the second part of the presentation by the Public Service Commission, of importance, I think, is I was just telling the Commissioner that I think I'll give him just about 5 minutes. There's this issue of the budget of the Public Service Commission being included in DPSA, Palama, and so on, and it was under Rule 11. According to me, it does give an impression that it's going to even make it more difficult for them to be able to negotiate for more funds through Treasury if necessary, if it's done that way. But I was just requesting the Commissioner, because I don't think the committee is aware as to how that came about. We just all understand that it's already included. That the Commissioner perhaps just says something on that for just about 5 minutes, and then we go on to the next presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this matter has been of concern over some time now to the Public Service Commission. Not only the Public Service Commission, in fact, and other institutions that are supporting democracy, the Chapter 9 institutions. You will recall that an ad hoc committee of Parliament was set up to review these institutions, including the Public Service Commission, and came out with a report and recommendations. Now, part of those recommendations, which we all supported, including all the Chapter 9 institution, was that the budget, in order to protect the independence and the perceptions of independence, I think the perception is more the key word here, because our concern is not so much that the budget of the Public Service Commission is taken away or is decreased based on any other consideration. So the independence, we felt and we supported that the perceptions of independence should be protected, in the sense that the budget, the votes, the money should come directly from Parliament for these institutions and the Public Service Commission. And that ad hoc committee made that recommendation. Now, even prior to that, there were suggestions, I think, or for proposals from Treasury that the budget of the Public Service Commission should be included within the budget of the DPSA. As it is now, the vote of the Public Service Commission has been separate from the vote of the Department of Public Service and Administration. My predecessor, the chairperson of the Public Service Commission, made a submission to Treasury and was supported by the Minister of the Department of Public Service and Administration, was supported in saying to Treasury that the ad hoc committee has made recommendations, and that's the position that we support. Now, in the response, Treasury has said that because that report has not been fully processed by the Parliament, the Treasury has suggested that prior to that, the budgets or the votes coming from Parliament, the budget of the Public Service Commission of Palama and I think CETA and all the others should fall within the vote level, which is the budget of the Department of Public Service and Administration. And as I said, we earlier had been against that, and I continue myself personally to feel that really the first prize is for our money to be coming from Parliament, because that protects the independence of the Public Service Commission. So that position we support. Now, when you come to the vote, because even previously, our vote, the Minister of Public Service and Administration still had to protect our vote, still had to present our vote to Parliament. And the perception, even in that scenario, was that the Public Service Commission is not independent. So that position already was compromising the independence as perceived by the public out there, but not in reality. So and we continue to want to find out what are the differences, and maybe our chief financial officer can explain more. I myself am not aware what the difference is if you have a vote which is for the commission, and or you take a budget within the vote of the DPSA, because both versions for me have always carried this perception that the Public Service Commission is not independent. But I don't know the intricate differences between those two, because remember that the chair was just pointing out that isn't that going to lead to more resources of the commission being taken away. I couldn't say that. I mean, I couldn't defend that fully to say that may be the scenario. But my suspicion that it may not lead to necessarily the money is being taken away. But I continue to worry about the perception that the DPSA, the Public Service Commission, is part and parcel of the DPSA as perceived by people out there.
Thank you, Commissioner.
On that point, I mean, it's a very valid point, and we actually, I'm not sure about my facts, so I'm asking a question, and maybe someone could get that information for us, maybe the researcher or... What is the situation regarding the other institution, the Section 9 institutions, Human Rights Commission, Public Protector, Auditor General, and so on? Because we just had got our agenda for all of this, of all the budget votes with the roster of when they're coming up. And They're not independent. They're not on that agenda. I don't see them featuring there independently or separately. So I don't know where they actually fall. But maybe that could guide us in this particular case.
No, in fact, it will not guide us much because those bodies under Chapter 9, institutions that fall under Chapter 9, their budgets have been part and parcel of various ministries to which they've been attached. Like you will see the human rights will be under the Minister of Constitutional Affairs. And so they've been worse off than the Commission in terms of having a separate vote. But what I'm saying is I don't know what the difference would be in terms of application of that and the threat, because the Chair was raising the question, isn't there a threat that when resources become scarce, they might begin to bite on the Commission? But I continue to make the point that I made earlier, that for me, really, the first prize, and that's what we should all be striving for, is that these institutions, including the Public Service Commission, should receive their budgets, ideally from Parliament, so that this independence is protected in reality.
Thank you. I think let's go on with that food of thought to the presentation on, I think, regulation of supply chain management practices.
Thank you, Chairperson, Honourable Members. This presentation is based on the report done by the Public Service Commission focusing on transactions in departments between 2004 and toward the end of 2007. Transactions in the area of supply chain management. We focus on the threshold of 200,000, which has since been raised to 500,000. But at the time the study was conducted, the threshold of 200,000 in terms of supply chain management practices, where it was not a requirement for departments to advertise the tender. So we focus on this threshold, as the Chairperson indicated, because the requirements are less strict compared to the bigger ones. The risk is also higher, given the flexibility that is available at this level of contracting. We'll have some introductory remarks, talk a little bit about what the legislative framework says, and then talk about our findings and recommendations. Our introductory remarks, the Chairperson indicates that we've got comprehensive legislation in place to help government departments manage risk and fraud and corruption in the procurement environment. However, incidents still occur, they still remain prevalent, and we see this both in terms of the complaints that are lodged on the Public Service Commission for us to follow up on and investigate, which a number of them involve allegations of corruption in the area of supply chain management. We also see this in terms of the hotline cases that we receive where the allegations relate to corruption in the area of supply chain management. We focus on the 200,000 threshold, which is a point at which it is required that the bid or tender evaluation process be undertaken, but as I indicated, it has since been the threshold has been since been raised to 500,000. The focus of the study was on two departments, public works and housing, looking at the national and the provincial counterparts as well. And given the large amounts of funds being made available for tenders in the two departments, that's why the Public Service Commission settled for those two departments in this study. The legislative framework, we made reference to the Constitution here in terms of how procurement processes should be facilitated in departments. We made reference to the Public Finance Management Act as well, that the accounting officer must ensure that they maintain an appropriate, fair, transparent, accountable, competitive system of procurement, as well as Section 76 of the PFMA, also which provides for Treasurer to make the necessary regulations to guide the process further. also Section 2 of the PPPFA, talking about the an organ of state determining its preferential procurement policy and implementing it, and also Supply Chain Management Regulation 3, issued in terms of the Public Finance Management Act by Treasury, specifying that the accounting officer must develop and implement an effective and efficient supply chain management system. We also looked at practice note number 2 of 2005, which was then talking about the threshold. That's the one that was talking about the threshold of 200,000. And these were the values that were specified at the time, that if you go into procure services from outside up to a value of 2,000 rand value-added tax included, you may procure without inviting bid or quotation by simply using your own petty cash in the department. If it's above the value of 2,000 rand but not exceeding 10,000 rand VAT included, you may procure by obtaining at least three verbal or written quotations from prospective suppliers. I think in this regard, the key issue also is that where you're having verbal quotations, there has still to be documentary evidence which shows who is the person who makes the call, who did they call, when the call was made, and so on and so on. So that even if it was a verbal quotation that was requested, at least there is documentary evidence in the department to create an accountable audit trail that people can follow up on. And then when the value is above 10,000 rand but does not exceed 200,000 rand VAT included, here you're talking about the written quotation as opposed to verbal ones, and using a database that the department may be running. What we did in this study is we looked at the regulatory framework to say what are the key procurement steps that need to be followed. Firstly, you invite quotations. So we then said in the sample of transactions, let's look at the extent to which there is documentary evidence, which demonstrates the extent to which appropriate steps were followed here to invite the quotations. There is evidence that indeed the required number of quotations was obtained. That there is evidence that the quotations were evaluated through an accountable process in the department, and that once the decision has been made to award the tender to a particular service provider, there is documentary evidence demonstrating that a proper request for delivery of services was then issued to the department. And once the services have been provided, there is proper evidence in the department showing that you had an original invoice from the department against which the payment was done. These are the five steps against which we assess the transactions in the department. And the issue there was really to say, let's take a sample of transactions. We took just over 1,600 transactions in this Department of Housing, Public Works, in the national and provincial level, to assess those transactions against this steps that are reflected here. And if you look at the findings here, you see that in terms of the first step of evidence of invitation of quotations, compliance with the procurement rules in this regard, that is an average compliance rate of 81%. But if you look at specific levels there, you know, a national, you see 54% compliance rate, which means that the very first step of making sure that there is evidence or documentary evidence that the right process was followed in the invitation of quotation, the compliance level there at national was quite low. The lowest, of course, being the Western Cape at 47%, and going up to the higher ones, the Northwest 87%, the Eastern Cape 83%, and so on. Now, the important issue here is that this business was based on a sample of transactions. It wasn't looking at all the transactions, but it already flags some issues for consideration here, that at the very first step of making sure that the right steps are followed when quotations are being invited, that the level of compliance is not adequate. Then we took it to the next step and asked the question around
the evaluation, the evidence that appropriate quotations were received, where you said three quotations must be received. Did we indeed receive three quotations? And where we ended up going ahead on the basis of fewer quotations, was the proper approval of the deviation by an authorized person? That's the evidence that was being looked at here. And here you see a lower average compliance rate across the department here of 55%. And again, a very low one at national level, 40%, and the Western Cape 42%, Northern Cape 41%, but the lowest being Gauteng at 19%, which means, as an example, that we have a situation where instead of proceeding on the basis of three quotations, you proceed on the basis of fewer than three, and you don't even obtain the relevant approval from an authorized person for that kind of deviation to be undertaken. The third step then is that on the once the quotations have been evaluated, the proper process of evaluating those quotations, where the proper steps and procedures followed in the evaluation of those quotations. Here you have an average compliance rate of 54%. It's quite low, and as we indicate there in the slide, the A suggests that the application of the criteria for awarding the order for goods and services is not always well controlled and monitored, and can be prone to abuse. Look at NESNA, 38%, again a very low one. Gauteng, 19%, a low one. Western Cape, 42%. The next step was then the one to look at evidence of request for goods and services from service providers, so that once the decision has been made to award a tender to a particular service provider, then you issue a formal request saying this is what we expect from you. Because if that is not done, how do you then end up assessing when they provide you with an invoice if they've done what they were required to do in the first place? So that kind of formal evidence communicating to a department, to a service provider, to request goods and services from them is quite critical in terms of the requirements here. There you see an average rate of compliance of 69% across the provinces and the national sphere, and the lowest there being KwaZulu-Natal at 24%. I think if you look at Mpumalanga as well, it's quite low. But higher compliance rates at 91% in the Eastern Cape, for example, 93% in the Northwest. But again, the issue to emphasize is that there is still space for improvement here, particularly considering two things. That here, the study was based on a sample of transactions. But secondly, that the threshold has since been raised to 500,000. So, which means that you'll have more and more transactions within this threshold. And the need to be much more rigorous in complying with the requirements becomes even more important here. Then the next step is to look at the assessment of evidence of payment, that payment was done on the basis of an appropriate invoice that is being submitted to the department, and you check against the services that have been provided. Here you have a higher compliance rate of 94%, and we indicate that at least at the level of payment, there is an encouraging level of due diligence, so that they exercise that due diligence in the payment of service providers, that invoices are supporting invoices are there before the payment can be effected. But of course, you see that the compliance level is not 100%, which means in some instances, Eastern Cape at 85%, there is still 15% room there for possible abuse where the payment payment processes are not being controlled appropriately. The recommendations we make in this report, the first one is that of ongoing forensic and other specialized audits within the supply chain management process, so that you can spot those areas where problems do occur. And of course, in line with the fraud prevention plans of departments, that regular fraud detection reviews across the supply chain management value chain
should be conducted as well. A critical one here is that of ensuring segregation of duties, so that the person, for example, inviting the tenders and the people, inviting the quotations and the people who evaluate those quotations and the people who issue the directive for services and the people who pay once the invoice has been approved, that you separate these duties to minimize possibilities of abuse of the system. Ensuring adequate supervision of the procurement process and a straightforward one, encouraging whistleblowing on maladministration and corruption, and emphasizing this issue of issuing formal requests for quotation, because where you leave it at a verbal level and there isn't even documentary evidence that I have called the following people at this time on this day inviting them, if that evidence is not there, it becomes difficult to confirm in the first place that this was a transparent process. Recording deviations in the supply chain management processes. I indicated, for example, that if you invite three quotations and you get only two, you can't just proceed with the two quotations without obtaining the necessary approval for the deviation from the authorized person. Payment of invoices should only be made on the basis of the original quotation, order form, and invoice. I think in terms of this last step, we said the compliance level is high, over 90%, but there is still room for improvement to make sure that payment of the invoices can only be made on the basis of the original quotation, order form, and invoice. Maintaining an updated list of service providers, because in terms of this threshold of 200,000 and now being 500,000, you do not necessarily have to go outside. You can ask for quotations from the internal list database that you have, but if that list is not updated, it ends up creating a problem because you end up not finding the right service providers for the service that you need provided to the department. And of course, the important issue of declaration of conflict of interest in terms of members of staff and those that are involved in the procurement process, and performance ratings of suppliers contracted to the department based on the service that they provide to you, so that you are assured of good service every time you go through the procurement process, because you will have assessed them based on the experience that you have had as a department. And these are the findings and recommendations that we make in the report.
Thank you very much. I think I like this part of the report, and perhaps the committee should also consider that these recommendations should actually be put forward in Parliament. I think it will assist in cutting in a lot of costs in terms of what's happening now. If you look at the way things have been run in Scopa and these other areas of work. Can I now take some hints from Honorable Dreyer, Honorable Ramatlakane? Anybody else for comment? Just before you ask questions, I'm just interested in knowing, is your calculation for the average rate of compliance based on those, all the provinces consolidated, or do you take it per province? It's consolidated. Thank you.
Thank you. Two things, and I comment from my side, and I'd like comment back from the Public Service Commission people. The last table, that's the overview of findings in respect of transactions evaluated. Then we set the average rate of compliance, and we suddenly see a huge kind of improvement in the level of compliance, average of 94%, and that relates to the due diligence exercise of the payment process. Now, while one should be happy to see that there's an compliance with some, at least with some of the areas, the some of the requirements, you know, this is actually worrying to me, because if you don't comply with a two or three previous steps, but suddenly you comply with the last step, namely the payment, but the process has already been corrupted at an earlier stage, this means that there's actually increases the risk of fraud, because there were no proper calls for quotations, it wasn't the calls, the submissions that were received weren't properly evaluated and so on, but then when you have the service delivered, you pay out very, very quickly. So you make sure that if your friend or your wife's business or whoever was it benefited from, that she or that person is paid very, very quickly. So this is actually worrying. It's not a positive sign. This should be part of the whole trend. This should be the last step in the whole process. If the previous steps on the compliance level is not so high, this one shouldn't be either. And it also shows actually a further thing. It's not just neglect. People are aware of the duties or what they should do. They neglect the first three steps, and suddenly they comply with this step. So it means that they are aware of the requirements. So that adds to it. And I just want us to be aware of that and to hear the comment of the Public Service Commission from about this. And then just a further comment, a second comment is, we're looking at the average rates and some, you know, not too good, 54% in the one table. Okay. But what is further worrying is that if you actually look at the breakdown between provinces that week, then you see the culprit in that particular case, Gauteng, only has 19% evidence of evaluation of quotas. That's a very worrying sign, and we should kind of then look further into that specific, because there's a huge problem there in Gauteng. That's what this table tells us. Just like to hear your comment. Have you further probed particular bad instances like Gauteng and this one? Or maybe that's something that we as MPs can take up and probe that situation further.
Thank you, Chair. Just about two questions, but the supply chain management is a very critical area of work in terms of this issue called tenders.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we must be worried when we look at a sample of two areas, two public works and housing, and the figures that we see in terms of the level of compliance that shows here, we must be very worried about what has not been sampled. So we must be very worried that this area is a very critical work, and the area of the degree of compliance here, and if you were to widen the sample, may be quite shocking. So I think we must say to the Commission that I think this is a good work that has been done here, but a bit worried about the scope, the wideness of the non-compliance. Now, linked to that question, Chair, is if you look at the sample, and the DG said now we threshold was 200, and he make an emphasis, now with the 500,000, which then means that the problem becomes much bigger. But what I can't get in the presentation is what informs the increase of the threshold from 200 to 500,000. Is it the degree or level of compliance, satisfaction? It can't be that. Because if you look at this sample, it doesn't give you that indication. It's just a feeling, a gut feeling that we must now increase this threshold from 200,000 to 500,000 because it's too much papers, and therefore we now minimize the papers with the global figure. Now, I just want to understand what informs this. Because logic probably would dictate that you should be able to, the level of compliance must inform you to move to a step higher. So that's the question there. The last question, Chair, is the kind of work that you've done here and the recommendation. How does it find its way? I'm asking the coordination question. How do we coordinate this work in order to inform these various levels that there is a red light flickering? And how does this coordination of this work, because I think that in terms of what the work that the AG, all other departments are doing, whether it's an audit committee, internal audit committee, that committee, how do we coordinate this effort that at the end of the day the right hand is communicating with the left hand in terms of this information? So that's the question. The second question I would like to know. In other words, if we even take this recommendation, we adopt them, the synchronization of the work that we do at all different levels, how are we doing with that synchronization of work and coordination of it, so that you have one kind of template that begins to say to everybody, this is how we dictate how that we do the business from now on at all different levels. But the last comment is that it worries the earlier point when we were talking about the budget and the kind of work that we need to do and the effectiveness of that work, that maybe at the next interval we really have to come back and have some discussion around this particular work in terms of that strategic zooming into the critical work that matters most. So perhaps we won't be able to do now because of the time, but at some point we need to come back to that, because I think for me this is the crux of the issue, the supply chain management. That's where the probably can become a cash cow areas in terms of the non-compliance.
Thank you, Shrekas. Any more questions from the other members? No. Let me then give an opportunity to respond.
Yeah, Madam Chair, again, I think that the Commission should recognize the compliments in terms of the quality of the report that the members are expressing. We appreciate that. And also to support the views of Member Treya, I think in terms of the importance or the significance of the high rate of compliance insofar as payments are concerned. I think that is a very well-founded remark, because it is at that stage where everybody wants to pay whoever, that we must find the documents to show that this happened, when in fact it never did happen, literally speaking. So I think that we should also recognize that. Now I will skip the other ones which are technical, except to say that for me the reason for increasing from 200,000 to 500,000 is really that of expediency and the cost increases. You see, if you are sitting at that end, then you realize that if you continue to put it at this level of 200,000, irrespective of what happens, you are having to work more, you are having to spend more resources, because now the prices have suddenly increased. When you were dealing previously with a few number of the ones that are 200,000, now they suddenly double because of the price increases, and you don't want to go there. And so what I want to read from what you're saying is that it is aligned to the statement I made earlier, that in fact it is at this level that administration should be checked all the time, because it is at this level that we are likely to get irregularities and corruption. I mean, all you need is trip quotations. And those quotations can be gotten whichever way you want. You know, you can even ask the one company to give you the three quotations, and you get away with it. So it emphasizes the point that we can't keep our eye off this particular board here. And so I think I support the spirit in which that was mentioned. But also the question of saying in the recommendations and their implementation, when we have this kind of a report, how do you coordinate the implementation of those recommendations? It reminds me of the presentation that we made last time to this committee, in terms of saying that we would want the committee to be aware that we have an interest as a commission to present to other committees of parliament. Because you see, this committee cannot, and ourselves cannot, coordinate everything that is here. For instance, we need to be able to alert the committees. As you say, what could be the situation in the health department or in the education department? Because we're only looking at housing and public works. So it's important that, for me, it's important that the committee on housing and the committee on the public works is also made aware of this report, not only at the parliament but also in the provinces, in the legislature, so that they make it their business to go into this report and be able to call departments to account, not only once to account to this, but also to show them, each committee, how they have progressed in tightening the controls in the manner that that has been outlined in the presentation. I thought I would just make those comments, but I'm sure there are other questions.
But
thanks
a lot.
Madam Chair,
do you want to answer?
Okay, let's just give him a chance. The DJ chance. Yeah, no, it's just the one issue that I wanted to add around the raising of the threshold. That it's something that Treasury does in terms of Section 76 of the PFMA to regulate the process. So they raise the threshold. And as a broader regulatory process, now the you can't go beyond. But the problem is that the Treasury processes actually allow accounting officers to lower the threshold. If you assess, you look at your department and you see, well, the risks are higher here, the systems are not tight enough. As an accounting officer, you may lower the threshold. What you can't do is you can't increase them. You can't increase the threshold. So you can't say, only at the level of 1 million rand will I go outside, because Treasury doesn't allow that. But you can say, no, in my case, because I think we still make sure that we strengthen our capacity as a department, and I'm lowering the threshold as follows. But that is not being done, of course. But just to add that point in terms of the changes around the threshold.
Honourable Grant, do you want to comment?
Madam Chair, yes. The recommendations in the last slide that we had, I think we as a committee are happy with this, but I want to make a further suggestion that we should now follow up on this. And as a committee, I propose now formally that we write a letter to each of the DGs or head of departments of the respective national and provincial departments that have been part of this investigation, and we tell them about the findings in brief and the recommendations, and ask them to please comply with this list of recommendations here and report to us as a committee. We want to know that they have actually taken note of this and implemented this, and we want deadlines. We want to give them a time by a certain date they must comply. And then the second recommendation is that we as a committee call not all these departments, but the KwaZulu-Natal Department of Housing, the Western Cape Department of Public Works, and the Eastern Cape Department of Housing, as well as the National Department of Public Works. Those departments that either did not comply at all with the request, or they sent their information so late that they couldn't form part of this investigation. So they clearly just ignored the Public Service Commission, and they may have a lot to hide. And I propose that we call them in and we have a hearing with them and interrogate them, and they, get them an opportunity to please account to us for not complying with this request from the Public Service Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Vitrea. I don't know, but I think this report is opening a can of worms. But at any rate, I think it's an issue that I think as a committee we should actually require from the Public Service Commission that the Secretary actually gets these recommendations, but with the thinking that they should also, you remember that we have these cluster portfolio committee meetings that you normally hold, be in available to actually come and present also in that cluster committee, because then the advantage is that it will rope in the other areas of work, other portfolios, for us to be able to bring this out. It might even be cross-cutting issues that might need us then to bring in committees related to public works, to human settlement, and so on. But I think it should be an issue that from here, for us to be seen doing something about the recommendations, that you be ready to present actually into the cluster committee, which would be of use to us, I think. And then also as a committee, we then also have an opportunity again to have a session with them, specifically on the issue of the supply chain management. I think most of us would like to interrogate more and actually go into further details as to your findings as related to by Honorable Dreyer. And then we also perhaps look at a possibility of an area of work for oversight then that could be directed towards us meeting our requirements in terms of compliance in departments, especially in local government. And that would also need us then to perhaps possibly communicate even with the ad hoc committee on public service delivery and try and get our information coordinated. But I think for this to end just here wouldn't really be doing justice to the Public Service Commission, but bring it out so that it can be an implementable instrument and perhaps even present it in Parliament, table it in Parliament from the committee.
Madam Chair, can I just take it? I'm not sure. I just want to clarify with you, from based on your comment that you've made, does that mean you're not accepting my recommendation as I've put it to committee now? You want to meet with other committees first?
What I'm trying to say is this area of work, the recommendations in particular, shouldn't just end here. And we hear what you are saying. But it must become an action that also goes into the cluster of our committee, the cluster groupings of governance and monitoring. As a committee, the public service portfolio committees coming together and having this particular presentation and us also having inputs from the other portfolio committees on these recommendations that have been put forward. It's actually a more broader, inclusive area of work for all of us.
Madam Chair, can I comment on that? We could do that, but you know, it means that we're going to postpone acting on this, and also by getting more committees involved and asking their input, we kind of dilute the whole thing. We've had a thorough investigation, we've had a thorough report, we've had a full, you know, presentation to us here by the Public Service Commission. They report to us, that's the right way, and it's up to us as a portfolio committee to take action or not, based on their recommendations. They don't have the teeth, they don't have the executive powers, they investigate and monitor and they report to us. Now it's up to us, we have teeth, to show the teeth. And I think it's time that we start showing our teeth and calling in offending departments. In the same way that SCOPA is doing very good work, they call in committees, and I'm going to quote the work of the Director General of the Treasury. When I served on SCOPA, he said to us at SCOPA, you're doing good work because you're putting the fear of God into these people. And I always remember his words ring in my ears. And it's time that other committees start doing the same thing. And I think while the SCOPA oversees the spending, the financial management or mismanagement of departments, we oversee the governance issues of departments across the whole civil service. This falls perfectly in our ambit, and I think we should call them in, and we should go ahead and do our work regardless. You know, we can also inform the other committees, but we shouldn't stop ourselves from doing what we should be doing and taking our jobs as members of parliament, taking our oversight role seriously. We should act.
Honourable Member.
Chair, I think the suggestions are complementary. I don't think necessarily that we are accepting recommendation as a committee, but we're saying beyond this, there is a need for the work that the question I raised about the coordination, that it now must be taken into a cluster so that the cluster is also informed, without necessarily undermining what we have, our own jurisdiction in terms of the work. So the work and the situation is complementary, in my view. This doesn't necessarily stop the Honourable Member Andrea's questions about us calling in the department for oversight work. That must happen as part of the action. But as part of another action is involving the cluster, because the cluster are also necessarily going to have to be very awake and alive to what is happening in that various department. So I think they are more complementary in my view. Chair, while I'm on the floor, excuse me for doing this, because we are now on the recommendations, see, that I should think that in the previous presentation, we did not necessarily entertain any recommendation there. I would like to suggest or to submit that given the issue of compliance, the 60 days that were talked about, including the non-compliance thereof, in the instances where there are very clear indication that there's a lack of compliance or refusal to comply, we should, as this committee, take the same position, that let's call in those departments, because the issue, I heard the president saying that they will have to amend the law because the people, the suspensions and people being paid while they're sitting at home is a problem, it's wastage of resources. But the law already makes provision that this thing must be done within 60 days. Some of the suspension are going into months, 8 months, 9 months. So I would like to recommend that as this committee, we now need to be saying these that are outside of the required period in terms of the Act, let's call them in. Let them come on account. Let's get that a DG or acting DG or the minister. Because at the end of the day, the buck stops with the minister, the executing authority. Now, my humble submission, Honorable Chair, is that we should start with this Department of Correctional Service. We read in the newspaper about the completion of the case, but the extension of the suspension that continues to go even though the case is complete. So I think we should be saying, let's get the facts. Person is being found not guilty. The commission also confirmed that this is in fact so. But the suspension continues. We continue to pay people while they're sitting at home. Can't be accepted. So we should have a call for those departments. And I think, Acting Chair, you would know other departments. There are other departments that we should be saying, as a resolution, we'll call them for them to come and tell us what are the difficulties in complying. Some cases will be justifiable. Some are simply not justifiable because you can see with your naked eyes that this is completely wrong. So let's put the program together. And my submission is that I want us to start with this Department of Correctional Service, because in my reading of the newspaper, case was long concluded. But the Director General continued to be at home and would pay. And they paid this... Director General are handsomely paid, I must add. So I think that that's my worry very, very. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Mahale, did you have a comment on this?
No, I've been partly covered by Honorable Ramat Lagani because I wanted to come to the issue that let's go the cluster route. And if I heard correctly, the chairman of the Public Service Commission says that they would like to present this to those departments. So if they're going to present to those departments, then we'll take it from there. We go the cluster route, they present to the concerned departments, then we will see where we meet.
Okay, Commissioner.
Yeah, no, I may have been misunderstood. I was saying in the response to the question of coordination, of saying how does this committee coordinate the oversight on these recommendations. And I was merely saying that previously we have said to this committee that we would also like to present department-specific recommendations to the committees of parliament that are like this one. So, but in this case, for instance, we have looked at the housing, departments of housing and departments of public works. Now, there are oversight committees that are specific to those sectors. And we were saying that we need now to present to them as well whenever an opportunity arises. Sometimes, of course, it may not be possible because you will find that the committee may be so inundated or their schedule may not allow. But we were saying last year to the committee that this is this is what we plan to do. So we will seek audience with these committees of housing and public works. But what I hear the suggestion now is that with or without that process, the other process should continue of calling the managers of this department to account to this committee. So we were not saying, I was not saying that we will report to the department themselves.
Okay. I think it's basically just about the coordination that you need to reach consensus on and communicate to each other as the portfolio committee. But I still maintain that it is important that you consult the cluster, because the cluster is our biggest platform of having these various portfolio committees coming together, and are also able to then target specific departments to say these departments must also be part of the cluster for us to be able to address these issues. But more so, it even gives it a stronger platform for us when it's presented in Parliament, so that this can be a practice for all the clusters, for that matter, these recommendations of supply chain management. It could actually cut down on these different sittings and committees and silos of work that we are doing. And in essence, yes, the Commission, it has done its area of investigation or area of research work, and here are the answers. It just says to us, we need to move a step further to say, this is what we are doing about these recommendations, to check for us to go back to departments and do oversight work without them implementing these recommendations. Then it means it's also just an area of fruitless expenditure, if I may say so, from our side as well, as the portfolio committee. Yes, we can call them in. We can be specific to public works. We can be specific to housing. But at the end of the day, you might find that the very same work has been done in the very portfolio committees of human settlement. The same work has been done in the very portfolio committee concerned with public works. So instead, it still makes sense to me to say, let's agree on, we might have to work on the approach or how we are going to conduct the work of the day or the business of the day. But I think we'd gain more if we do it in the form of a cluster. And also on the side of the Public Service Commission, I think it also gives them a bit of better room or more area of people being more informed of their work, and also them reaching a conclusion to what they're doing by us actually being able to have such a platform in the form of a cluster. So I should think that we are actually going that route instead of having to do a repeated work that takes us nowhere. Okay, before I close off the meeting, is there any other comment?
Thank you, Chairperson. Now, I think Honourable Dreyer and myself will agree with what you've just said, just as long as it doesn't take 60 days or more to get to a conclusion. It's quite timely, isn't it?
Just become labor. Okay, I must give a big thank you to the Public Service Commission and everybody present from the department or from the commission. You've got a big task, and I don't want to say it's going to go easier, but it certainly is helping us as public service and administration to become, I think, as Elia said, to become more robust. Because as a portfolio committee, we have the challenge of us being an activist parliament. We have to implement, but more so in implementing, our evaluation and monitoring processes must come to a conclusion. We must see ourselves moving to a better developmental state. And a lot of issues, especially when it comes to issues of the budget, supply chain processes, issuing of tenders, and, you know, the labor relations as well, in terms of the way cases are being handled, I think are the most sore areas, which then also says to me, perhaps we might also have to look at the bill on the public administration management bill, and it does sort of direct us towards actually making that priority of us working towards the third single public service, or rather the integrated public service. And in those few words, Commissioner, thank you very much. And I declare the meeting closed. Thank you.